Now we're going to take your phone calls for our two guests, Mike Heiser, Daryl Bach. And then a little bit later on this hour, we'll be joined by Glenn Kimball and William Henry. The last hour of tonight's program will be just open lines, just you and me. We'll be back in a moment as we continue to talk about this story on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. We're reacting to the story where filmmakers and researchers say that they have unveiled two ancient stone boxes that they say may have contained the remains of Jesus and Mary Magdalene. Well, we're reacting right now with Daryl Bach and Mike Heiser. We're going to take your calls this half hour. And what I'll do, Daryl and Mike, is even though the question will come in, each one of you will have an opportunity to answer it. So let us go to the phones now. East of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast with us. Hello there.
Hello, George. This is Juanita from Windsor-Locks, Connecticut.
Hi, Juanita. Go ahead.
Good morning to you. I'm nervous, I'll tell you. My heart's beating a mile.
Nervous because of the discovery or because you're on the program?
No, on the program.
Okay. Now,
I'm not a biblical scholar, but I have to tell you that the New Testament not only talks to the life of Jesus Christ and his death and his resurrection and transformation, but the Old Testament foretells it. So it definitely is a fairy tale if anybody wants to tell me his bones were put anywhere.
All right.
Now, fairy tales work real well this week because even Al Gore won an Oscar for one yesterday. So that's probably why they're doing it.
Mike Heiser, your reaction first. Thanks, Juanita.
Well, I think I just have to laugh. I think I think she's right and put some good humor to it.
Daryl?
Discernment's a wonderful thing.
I guess. Aren't you two going to watch this on March 4th? I know you were saying, Daryl, that you got a little preview, but are you going to be sitting in front of your television sets that day?
No, I probably have better things to do since I've already seen it. I might take a look at it just to see what's changed, to see if they did anything to it in light of the reaction that they've gotten, because they can still have a week to play with it.
Well, was there anything on it that was of interest to you?
From a standpoint of the basic claims, no. I mean, there's a lot of, in fairness, there's a lot of good information about ossuaries, about, how burial worked in the first century. There's a feel for how archaeology takes place and finds things, and the processes that they go through to map out the locations once they get there. So that kind of stuff is, I think, will be interesting to people. The thing that makes it tricky is that you've got those dimensions to the story, and then on top of that is this layer of claims, which looks like it's the same kind of thing when in fact it isn't. And that really is the kind of media deception that's going on with the way this is being done.
Wherever I am, whatever city I may be in, I always seem to come across a cemetery, and I'm always marveled by the tombstones and some of the ages. I know in Baldwin, Missouri, in Manchester, Missouri, there's a cemetery there that has bodies in there from 1700s, practically, 1700 plus. In this era that we're talking about, 2,000 years ago, did they put everybody in a tomb when they died? I mean, how many tombs are there out there?
Mike, you want to take a shot at that, or you want me to let
I would say, no, not everyone can afford a tomb. And just by the sheer statistics, the numbers of the ossuaries, many people didn't even have that. That's one thing that sort of mystifies me about all of this. And, Daryl, since you've seen sort of an advanced viewing of this, maybe you could answer this for me. Do they say anything in there about the statistics that are offered on the National Geographic website? Because they don't make any sense at all.
You mean in terms of who's likely to have had an ossuary and that kind of thing?
Yeah, if you actually go up to the National Geographic website, they have a PDF document, and at the last page of it is a statistics table, and the statistics don't make any sense at all. For instance, they have a list of frequency of names, and it has Jesus 1 in 190, Mary Omni 1 in 160, and then they do all this math. Well, if you just go to the ossuary books and look in the back at the indexes, that those numbers aren't even close to what's actually there. And if Richard Baucom has put out numbers, I think I saw these on your website or Ben Witherington's, but if you actually total up the number of names on ossuaries, you get 396. And of those 396 names, 109 of them are Jesus, Mary, or Joseph.
That's right.
I mean, it's just unbelievable, but the National Geographic PDF are just, I mean, utter nonsense. And they don't tell you where they're getting the numbers.
Well, I think what you've got is someone is saying, what are the chances? It's a statistical claim, and I'm not a statistician, so I don't know how they do the numbers other than they have to assume this is a family tomb to begin with and then say, what are the chances of getting six names that actually match, you know, the family of Jesus in one location?
Well, I'd say if you have 109 names out of 396 ossuaries, it's pretty high.
Yeah.
Yeah, that you'd have more. You could probably have 20 tombs with these names, these combinations of names in there.
Well, the illustration that I heard today was if you filled a stadium with 50,000 people and you asked how many were named Jesus and 3,000 stood up, and then you asked how many had a father named Joseph, that would reduce it to 378. And then as you go down the list, you get more and more people sitting down till you end up with only one, you know. That's the way they see this as working. But, again, before you even get to applying the statistics, you've got to know that you've got a family tomb. You've already mentioned the social dimension of this, which we haven't mentioned up to this point, which is that that only the wealthy would have had such a family tomb.
Right.
And so Jesus's family didn't operate in that social scale. At best, they were part of a very thin-layered middle class, since Jesus' father did have a carpentry skill. But that's not going to get you to a family ossuary and bone boxes located in, you know, in a special part of Jerusalem.
Right, and you'd have to wonder why Joseph of Arimathea's tomb, you know, was needed, because if Joseph had left them any land or any sort of plot or any sort of financial means, why would that become necessary?
As I said, at virtually every step, you can think of it as a slideshow, and you've got 20 slides. At virtually every slide, there's a question to be asked about the evidence, and all of them have to line up for this to be true. I've compared this when I talked to Time Magazine today about attempting to connect dots that simply cannot be connected.
Okay, let's go back to some more calls. Let's go to our wild card line. Welcome to Coast, you're up with us.
I'm sorry, but I wholeheartedly disagree with you guys. So let me throw a few quick points at you. First of all, you stole my thunder a little, because that stadium example, it was done on CNN and is very interesting if you look at that. It's a very good way to look at the fact that this would be a rarity to have so many. It's 50 times 20 times 15 times 30 times 10. It's not, you know, so simple to brush off the statistics. It's some interesting material you can look at online. And Jose, that nickname, was very unusual and apparently is in Scripture. But here's my point. The low-key burial would be, it makes sense to me, in a sense, some aspects of low-key, because you don't want the Romans to mess with your grave. But you still want to be in Jerusalem because it's the capital of the Jews, and he was supposedly considered, I suppose, by Christians to be the king of the Jews. And Jerusalem is classically fought over, and that's why, you know, Jesus is supposedly, when I was in Israel, buried in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, correct? Which is right nearby. I mean, these places are they're, you know, frankly, a stone's throw. You can do a couple days walk, you know, between, you know, almost the entire country. So, you know,
did you see the pictures of these bone boxes that were revealed today?
Yes.
Did you notice how one of them was extremely ornate and the other one was very simple?
Well, listen, first of all, you guys are also portraying this as if it's like, oh, so organized and structured and all at the same time. Stuff could have been moved around. People die. You know, frankly, look at the news today with people being buried and moved around. They're in Israel at that time, apparently, for a 150-year period, this is the particular way things were done. But if that's the case, I think it's very interesting because, first of all, I'm not a Christian, but I wouldn't deny you guys a religion. And if there's a resurrection, that's fine. I don't think that finding, frankly, even physical material there, you know, that might be from some part of a body, would invalidate your religion. You know, I'm all for it. I just think we should be more, you know, less blowing it off. But, you know, and again, I have to say, I mean, you know, frankly, George, it would be nice to balance it out with some not bias to the other side, but at least neutrality.
You can't find him.
Well, listen.
Find me
let's
one.
Let's put it this way. You guys are, I mean, yes or no. I mean, just honestly, not to be confrontational, but you guys are the same guys that think that all the UFOs we're all seeing are basically all fallen angels, correct?
Absolutely not. I have no position on UFOs whatsoever.
All right. Well, bottom line is, the point is, we cover a lot of material on this show, and, you know, to to be so, you know, to not look at the hard evidence, which Cameron, frankly, who is clearly a very intelligent man, who needs, you think he needs more money? $1.7 billion for Titanic alone.
Well, I would question that this idea
the
that they're using hard evidence.
If you look closely at it,
where do the numbers come from?
The idea is to look at it and be honest and say, look, if we're open to science, let's look at it. Maybe it's intriguing. I think, frankly, if it's something that shows a unity of family and, you know, so on and so forth, it's so great. I just don't want to see people divided anymore by religion. Like, clearly, internationally, we're all at the potentially, you know, this self-fulfilling prophecy of end of the world because of all the end of the worlders in religions. I'd like everybody to chill out.
I think you're mixing in this subject with that, and I personally would excuse myself from that position. But if we want to talk about scientific evidence, don't just give me 50 times 20 times 10 times 15. Tell me where the numbers come from. The data is not identified.
You
don't
know
it's plucked out of the ether, and that is not scientific.
You don't know this is a family tomb. You have different kinds of ossuary boxes in this tomb. You dismissed the idea that this would be a simple burial box, but then why do you have this ornate burial box right next to it? Those are all basic archaeological questions that any archaeologist would be asking about this kind of a find.
If we're talking about scientific method, that's having a firm grasp on the obvious. These are basic questions, as Daryl just said.
Well, and Shimon Gibson, who was one of the three archaeologists who first discovered this tomb in 1980, said of the film's claims, "I'm skeptical about the thing."
Well, that's because he knows the data.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And even James Charlesworth raised a question of Princeton, who was there at the news conference, raised a question about the ornate nature of this one box versus the simple nature of the other one, and expressed hesitation that if there were a burial box of Jesus, that it would be left in such a simple way.
And how do you prove one way or another that, you know, it was the burial box of Jesus?
Well, I mean, obviously, it would take all kinds of combinations of things. I mean, one of the problems that we have, in all honesty, is that it's very hard to prove very much of anything beyond a shadow of a doubt with ancient material, because you're only dealing with part of the evidence, and you've got to have a whole lot of context in order to be able to really nail the thing down tight. So the best you can do is make a kind of a case. But let me give you an example with the DNA, because I think this is really important. The claim is, you know, there's this error about the DNA. All that they proved was that two boxes had people in it who were not related. Now, again, I'll ask this as I did earlier. How many people am I not related to in the world? How many people are you not related to in the world? That's a significant amount of people. So that's not a surprising find. That's a normal find. And then the fact that you have people who don't match DNA, and you didn't test any of the other boxes in the group, means that you don't even know if this is a family tomb, because once you get a non-match, the possibility is, well, maybe you have 10 boxes and none of them match.
And if they're doing the kind of shuffling around that the caller just mentioned, you could have any number of people from any number of families in that tomb.
Who took the bones? If they, regardless of who was in the box, who took the bones?
I think a lot of that happens just with, you know, people who, you know, want such things for fetish purposes, you know, just sort of like a sacred object or a relic, or they can sell things and claim it's from this or that, or, you know, things just get ransacked too.
Yeah, I mean that's not unusual for this kind of material either. The surprising thing would be to have the bones.
Yeah, most ossuaries, again, and the listeners can, you know, find these sources in a good library, these ossuary sources. Most ossuaries that are found are empty.
How could information that would have been so critical 2,000 years ago fall by the wayside? You would think that eventually, if they had a tomb of Jesus, that everybody would know exactly where it was through the ages. So why the need for the discovery? How come we just don't know this?
Well, it's a very interesting question, you know. Why don't we know where any of the other relatives are buried? And I think that what happens is that this is an area in which there's been a lot of disruption of history over a long period of time. There was a long period of time when Christianity at its very beginning was just struggling to survive. I mean, and so these places wouldn't have been necessarily nailed down that and that kind of thing. So you know, we forget, I think, we assume that the way in which our culture works and the way we remember things is what happened in the ancient world, and it didn't always work the same way.
Now let's go to our first-time caller line. You're on the air with us. Good morning.
Hi, George.
Hi.
First-time caller.
Thank you.
This is an interesting debate you're having here, because this is my field of study, which I've spent over 40 years
Excellent. In. Well, tell me a little bit about your take on the story today, then.
Well, number one, the body of Jesus Christ was begged for by Simon of Cyrene and laid in a tomb. Now, Simon was in the Pharisee line. Okay, he basically wanted to get the body off the cross and buried because the high day was coming. He would have been unclean to participate in the feast that was coming up in Jerusalem at the time. It was Nicodemus who went later on after Simon buried the body and then anointed the body because that body was anointed with spices. Jesus Christ rose from the dead. There was no body there. When Peter went into the tomb, he saw the grave clothes, but no body in it. He saw the face wrap that they put over his face, neatly folded there. There was no bones. If you look at the New Testament, those whom Jesus Christ has called are going to get a new body, because people don't understand that when man was originally made, formed, and created, he was body, soul, and spirit. When Adam committed the sin, they lost spirit. That's what died. I believe the Hebrew word is tohu vabohu, which means that very day that you do what I told you not to do, you're going to die. Well, we know that Adam and Eve lived some 800 years after that, physically, but spiritually they died. If you look in the Old Testament, anytime God wanted to communicate with man, he had to come into a concrete form that they could physically see, hear, smell, taste, or touch using their five senses. They no longer had spirit. Now, God could put his spirit upon
Okay, hold on. But what are you saying?
What I'm saying is Jesus Christ's bones would not have been there. He was resurrected.
Ah, okay.
His whole body was resurrected. If you remember, when he went to Jerusalem, he found the disciples behind closed doors for fear of the Jews. That was in his resurrected body. Some of the disciples weren't there. I believe Thomas wasn't there on one of the occasions.
All right.
He was there.
We've got a minute to go. I want to get your reaction, Daryl and Michael, before we say goodnight to both of you.
Well, here's what I think is important about what this caller is saying, and that is that we never would have gotten to the point of the bones being put in an ossuary with Jesus if the biblical materials are correct. They would have, that body was raised on the third day. There was nothing there. There was no deterioration to be able a year later to go back and put bones into a box.
Michael Heiser, 30 seconds.
Yeah, I would have to agree with that. I mean, and as an earlier caller said, the Old Testament has to be, you know, given some credit here too. You know, the prophet said, the psalmist, that you know, these bones, this person, this Messiah, that they would not see corruption.
All right, both of you, thanks so much for being on the program and shedding your perspective to this story. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Thank you, George.
Thanks, Michael. And when we come back, William Henry, Glenn Kimball joins us before we go into special calls with you as well, and then open lines at the end of the hour tonight. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. You know, we're winding down the free double CD offer, so if you've been thinking about getting it, now's the time. You simply subscribe to the After Dark newsletter. This double CD of Art's interviews with the late Catholic priest and exorcist Father Malachi Martin will be yours. Your subscription will begin with the March issue. Read about the mysteries of EVPs. Can the dead really find ways to communicate with us through audio recordings? And there's Lex's questions and answers with paranormal investigator Joshua Warren as well. So get the double CDs and the After Dark newsletter by calling 1-888-727-5505 or go online at coasttocoastam.com. Two more guests for you now on this incredible story. William Henry, author, investigative mythologist. He is also the co-host of Whitley Strieber's Dreamland radio program. William Henry is on a mission to reveal the lost codes and myths and symbols. He's been a regular guest here on Coast to Coast. Hello, William. How are you?
Wonderful, George. So great to hear your voice.
Likewise. Looking forward to getting your reaction to the story today. And Glenn Kimball, of course, is a regular guest on Coast to Coast as well. He's an expert in ancient manuscripts. He has got a B.A. in journalism, M.A. in communications. He has been one heck of an instructor at the Southern Illinois University, ranked by student evaluators in the top 10 instructors at the university. Glenn Kimball, I guess. Of course, how many instructors did they have at the university, Glenn?
About 800.
Good. I thought you were going to say 10. I'm kidding. You
are. that would might even been better, George.
I know. You're one of the best. Good to have you with us, Glenn.
Good to be here.
Glenn, give me your take on this story, this so-called discovery.
Well, you know, the claims of the body of Jesus being located in different tombs and the claims of Mary Magdalene being located in different tombs are prolific. We know that there's a serious case to be made, at least by Japanese people, that Jesus was married in Japan. There's a serious case by Sue Olson and an Islamic connection that Jesus and Mary Magdalene are buried in Kashmir, following that he survived the cross and went to Kashmir after his supposed crucifixion. There's claims of Jesus' tomb in Africa. There's claims of Jesus and Mary Magdalene in Western Europe. There's not enough bodies to go around. George, if you followed every single one of the legends, it would be you'd be going stir crazy
forever
because one of the things that really peaked and crescendoed by the 10th century was the fact that if you could have an artifact or some claim to fame, that people would pilgrimage to your church and pay their tithes and offerings, and it was one of their revenue centers for them by that moment in history. But if you wanted to find out where the people really went and why it's impossible that Mary Magdalene could have possibly been buried with Jesus in Jerusalem, that's a story that's really rather well documented. And Mary Magdalene was not buried in Jerusalem. It's impossible.
All right, William Henry, your take.
Well, first of all, I highly commend James Cameron and his crew for putting together this amazing story, this wonderful educational opportunity for everybody, because it's bringing together so many diverse points of view and putting a very important question on the line. What exactly happened to the body of Jesus? And we're not going to find any bones anywhere. If anything, I would submit that what they might have found in those ossuaries would be toenails, hair, or fingernails. And the reason I say this is because drawing upon the Tibetan tradition, there is a very deep body of knowledge surrounding this whole idea of the rainbow body, the body of light, the resurrection body. And when the human body accesses the nerve channels that run throughout it, it can transmute itself into a light being. You have the capability to do this, George. So do I. And what was demonstrated at this time 2,000 years ago was this incredible possibility that is wired into each and every one of our bodies. And that, to me, is something that is being overlooked in this whole conversation. I agree with Glenn. You can make a case for Rennes-le-Château, France. They talk about the tomb of God being located there. FDR, as I wrote in my book, The Atomic Christ, sought the sacred most precious casket of Christ in Mongolia in 1934. We have letters about the expedition specifically referring to this casket. And what FDR sought is the same thing I think we all should be looking for as well, which is the esoteric aspect of this. He knew you were not going to find the bones of Jesus or Mary Magdalene. What you were going to find, though, is evidence of this transformation into a body of light, a vortex of energy into which these adepts could transform themselves upon dying.
That's what it's going to all come down to, whether we believe that this human named Jesus had the ability to resurrect.
And that, you're right, George. That is the whole question right there. Strangely, this event is never described in the Bible. It is the foundation of Christian faith, in fact, Western civilization. But we don't know what happened or how did it happen. It's a lost event. It belongs to the mystery tradition. But now I think we're starting to be able to come into a time in history where we can look back and say, hey, you know, this is really an incredible event here. What are the details of their resurrection? Because the details are so incredible that we should do a whole show on it, really, because there is so much here, so much that we are learning, and it's a subject of immense fascination for many, many people.
Glenn Kimball, what's truly the rationale behind this documentary? I mean, I don't think it's money for the people involved. I mean, what message are they trying to get to everybody?
Well, first of all, the network that is on, and I won't mention the network, but it's been mentioned on the air here this evening. In my travels to Egypt, for example, this year and a half ago, when we went to take some photographs of the places where Jesus had gone as a child with the Holy Family, while they were in exile in Egypt, you could not take your cameras into these locations. They were restricted by this very same network who had bought up all the rights to the story of Jesus in Egypt, period. And in addition, they bought up all the rights to the Gospel of Judas,
mm-hmm.
And they bought up all the rights to the Talmud Emmanuel. They are systematically buying up what sells a great deal, and that is the story of Christ. It's a bestseller. It's capitalizing on Dan Brown. Dan Brown is my hero in my mind. I've never met him, but I'd love to meet him.
Why? Why is he the hero?
Because he said the thing that... to people that was very would have caused him to be put up to ridicule, and that was the fact that Jesus may have been married to Mary Magdalene, and wrote a story about it, and this was not fun. This ended up not being a panacea for Dan Brown. It ended up being a very, very difficult trial for him, even though he made $75 million off of it. It was a very difficult thing for him to do, but he's unlike the other people that are doing this particular venture who are cashing in on this Jesus story, which is it's an old thing.
Yeah,
I mean, it's a story back 2,000 years ago. The Roman Empire itself had found out how much money the patrons had come and left at the church in at the temple on the Temple Mount. And they literally came and destroyed the Temple Mount, took it down brick by brick, milled off all of the metal inside the temple, and took it to Rome and used it as the revenue to build the Colosseum. That was the money they used to build the Colosseum in Rome. And when they figured out that they could make that much money off dismantling the temple, there were other reasons to take various and sundry pieces of the story of Christ and make revenue off of it, and that's what's happened over the centuries. The artifacts, the tithes and offerings of the people, it has been both a glorious story and a sad story at the same time.
Well, I'm getting two sets of emails, primarily those who simply say that they do not believe that these stone boxes contain the remains of Jesus and Mary Magdalene, and I don't know if their belief system will ever change, regardless of what may or may not be found. The other group just simply says, I'm tired of this religious stuff, and I don't want to hear it anymore. What's the significance, Glenn Kimball, of all of this anyway?
Well, I think the significance is that the original story of religion is a story of history all the way back 100,000 years ago. We take, for example, something that would be interesting for this particular audience. You take the story of the Anunnaki, which Zachariah Sitchin has so ably presented on the air. The part that he's left out was the fact that if you look at the Anunnaki, or at the Sumerian exhibit that toured the Royal British Museum and the Louvre in Paris, and you take the one statue that is the statue of representing an Anunnaki individual, or the Anunnaki himself, if you look at it very closely, it's a man nailed to a cross.
Mm-hmm.
And this individual was nailed to a cross and predicted that he would be resurrected. And so the story of crucifixion and resurrection is an extremely old, original tale that precedes certainly Christianity as we know it at the time of Christ. Certainly the earliest known records of the Jews, It comes out of the earliest records of the Sumerians. It comes out of the records of India. It comes out of the records of China. It comes out of the records that Hesiod put together for the Great Alexandria Library. And those records come out of the Atlantean traditions, the Lemurian traditions, and all the way back to the King Cronos, the first king of the first epoch of mortality.
Glenn, in terms of archaeology, we know there's been an effort to try to find the Ark of the Covenant, the Holy Grail, regardless of what it may depict, and the push, of course, to find the tomb. Are archaeological digs in that region prevalent, happening all the time, or are they pretty scarce?
In Jerusalem, they're pretty scarce. It's hard to get a license to do it. In Egypt, they're almost non-existent unless you're a member of Zahi Hawass's team, which Zahi's a wonderful man and is fun to work with. But to get a license to do these kinds of things, even in Greece, it's extremely difficult to get a license to do any archaeological digs in Greece. Look at Vindal Jones, ask him how difficult it has been for him to do the digs in Qumran. It's been a constant 40-year battle for him. These things are difficult at best to do.
William Henry, are we going to just have to go on belief, do you think, and the quest will continue, but we may never find the true answer?
Well, I think so, and again, getting back to like Cameron, he did a phenomenal job with his Exodus presentation last year with the same crew, and now he's taken on this subject here. I'd like to see him next take on this whole subject of bodily transformation. I remember, when Glenn's talking about the Anunnaki, they may or may not have come here in spaceships. I mean, you can make a very good argument that some of these beings demonstrated for us this bodily ascension, like those mentioned in the Bible with Enoch, Mary, Elijah, and possibly Moses as being figures that affected the same transformation of their body into a light being. And that's the real question that we're talking about here, because who cares about an ossuary? Who cares about some of this other stuff? What we really want to get to are what are the ultimate esoteric knowledge that's contained in these events. And that is what has been withheld from us from virtually the very beginning of this story.
Glenn, who takes these bones out, regardless of whose bones they may be? What happens? Why are they pillaged?
The bones themselves are pillaged as artifacts. If you tour the cathedrals, both of Asia, but especially as you get into Central and Western Europe, we put these things on exhibit. They are traded back and forth between religions. I know that the bones of Mark were traded between the Coptic Christian faith and the Christians themselves. These things are traded back and forth almost like baseball cards. I apologize to be irreverent about that, but that's the way they do them. And they do it because they cause a pilgrimage of people, an interest in the people to come and contribute to the welfare of a particular church. That's not always been the case. Temples were largely the site where you brought your tithes and offerings prior to the dismantling of the temple in 70 AD by the Roman Empire. That's where they did it. But they didn't know how to reconstruct a temple back in the original format. That's what the Knights Templar found when the Knight French the nine French knights that were members of the Fraternal Order of John found and converted themselves into the first nine Templars. They found the secret of the original temple and why it was originally built.
And what might have that casket been that the Templars possessed, Glenn?
The casket, what the Templars found, they fit on the back of a horse.
Mm-hmm.
And it was not a casket. A casket wouldn't have fit on the back of a horse. It was a group of manuscripts that they took from the Temple Mount, beneath the Temple Mount, and wrote it back. And it, basically what they did was by the time they got back to France and they began telling everybody what they had found, that they had found the original temple protocol, that every single person, rich and poor, were willing to contribute to this enormous building fund, which would have reconstructed the original temple and put it back in operation the way it originally was. And that would have conflicted with all of these churches who had artifacts and relics, which were the things churches. If they'd have put a temple back in operation, it would have changed the literally the cash flow entirely. That's part of the reason why the Templars were exterminated in 1307, was because they threatened the financial wherewithal of the powers that be at that particular moment in history.
Glenn Kimmel, are you a believer in the resurrection theory?
Yes.
You are, indeed. Even though it's possible you think Jesus may have traveled around?
Yes.
Glenn, William?
Oh, absolutely, George. I mean, this is the fundamental idea of Christianity. It's the founding principle of the religion, but it's found in numerous traditions. George Osiris did the same thing. You find the same tradition in the Tibetan tradition. And what I'm attempting to do is go into these other traditions and pull some of these pieces together. It forms an extraordinary story, and again, points to this idea that you and I can do this too. We just don't orient our lives that way.
What is it about this ability to resurrect, to be able to literally, you know, raise your body from the dead? Was it magic, William, or was there really something here?
Well, it's really about shifting the body's vibration into a vortex of energy as much as anything. Again, the Tibetans have a very precise science about this. I'm working through an amazing book called The Dalai Lama's Secret Temple that lays this all out. This was the secret temple that the Dalai Lamas would go behind the Potala Palace, where on the walls of this temple was this whole story laid out of affecting the transformation into a body of light. We see the same thing in the Egyptian temples, and it's profound to think about it. And again, we don't see imagery like this. We see images of Jesus on the cross suffering for our sins, but we don't see as many images of the transfiguration when he took the disciples up to the mountain and turned into this body of light. We don't see enough imagery of the incredible gateway imagery when Jesus is standing in front of the gateway of concentric rings, similar to what we see on the Mary Magdalene casket here, and he enters the gateway into another realm. It's just our culture has to shift away from the suffering premise into this ascension premise that enables us to get a hold of this whole teaching.
Glenn, we took your recommendation and got Gunnar Thompson on last week, and it reminds me a little bit about this, that things happened so many years ago, thousands of years ago, that, you know, people just don't have the answers for.
Well, certainly they don't, and if you were to look for evidence like bringing it into a laboratory. There is evidence if you cross-reference text and you take a curvilinear mathematical approach. We hear the music coming on,
yes,
and
sir.
What a wonderful job you've done, George, bringing this all together.
We'll be back in a moment with Glenn Kimball and Mr. William Henry. And William, I want you to talk more about FDR and his quest for the casket of Christ. I'm George Norrie. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.